Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. On this edition of Michigan Writers on the Air, I'll be chatting with Heather Shoemaker about her debut children's book, The Griffins of Castle Cary. Then veteran women's fiction author Tanya Ann Crosby will read from and talk about her most recent novel, Everyday Lies. This spring and summer, there will be a lot going on at the Interlochen College of Creative Arts for adult writers. Betsy Braun, the manager of the program, will provide an overview of this summer's offerings. At the end, Fleeta Brown will read some shipwreck poems by Michigan writer Cindy Hunter Morgan. I'm delighted to welcome Heather Shoemaker to Michigan Writers on the Air. Heather, when you were last here, we were discussing your newest book then, Saving Arcadia, a story of conservation and community in the Great Lakes. Today, we will be talking about your new book, The Griffins of Castle Cary. And this is a very different book. This is your debut children's book. What made you switch gears and write a novel for children?
Well, I've always been wanting to write novels for children, I think ever since I was 4 years old. So it doesn't feel like switching gears to me, although people who are used to my previous books, which are all three nonfiction for adults, might be a bit surprised. But to me, it feels like coming home.
And those early children's books, you were writing books before you could read or write.
Yeah. I was always telling stories and wanting to be a children's author. So I was a late reader. I didn't read till I was seven. But I was writing books well before then. And I would dictate my stories to grown-ups and draw the pictures, and they would write the words for me. But they were published books as far as I was concerned, because they had cardboard covers, which meant they were hardbacks.
Oh, that's a great way to start. This book is set in southwest England near Glastonbury. It's a beautiful area with old cathedrals and castles. What made you decide to set the book there?
Well, I have a lot of ties to England. I have a lot of family that lives there. And I lived in England as a child for a year and went to school there. So I got to wear the British school uniform and experience life as an 11-year-old in England. And this particular part of England, Somerset, is where my family lived. And so it's where I visited the most. And to me, it was a natural place, if you're going to write an adventure that involves ghosts, to put the children who are visiting England in a place that just has a lot of ancient history at their fingertips.
Without giving too much away, would you give us a brief summary of the story? There are lots of interesting characters.
Sure. It's about three children who go to visit England and visit their aunt. And when they're there, they sort of stir up some local ghosts, including a ghost child who is longing for a permanent playmate. So the older two kids have to unravel the mystery and race to save their sister before the ghost child takes something that doesn't belong to her.
So the three children, ages?
Two of them are close in age, 10 and 11, and then they have a younger kid sister.
And the younger kid sister has had a history of imaginary friends before this, right?
Yeah, so at first, talking about a friend that seems like an imaginary playmate doesn't raise any eyebrows, but she's quite upfront about who she's playing with, but no one really understands that it's a ghost.
And you make a difference between the children who can see ghosts and who can't, and that's sort of age-related.
Yeah, in my mind, a ghost is a bundle of emotions and feelings that lingers on in the earth. So if somebody dies with a great longing or big feelings, that person will turn into a ghost. And the children, in my version of the world, are the ones who can sense the ghosts the best. And really, the younger the child, the more they seem like a real person. And the oldest child in my story, the ghosts are sort of flickering in and out, like bad reception. And so sometimes she can see them and sometimes she can't, and sometimes she can just sense the feelings. And that makes it, of course, more of a challenge to figure out what's going on if you can't really see what's in the room with you.
So could you read from the book and give our listeners a sense of what the story sounds like?
Sure. I will read from the opening. This is chapter one. If you know much about ghosts, you'll know that waiting is one of the things a ghost does best. ghosts have the patience of eternity. Each April the ghost stirred. It coughed, cried, and blew its nose, then rose to the surface. April is an in-between season, a time when cracks split open along the ancient path from winter to summer, from death to life, a time when accidents might happen. This year the ghost dislodged a beetle from its ear and wafted up to the walnut tree. There it settled in a crook of branches. Leafless twigs scraped, the buds on the brink of bursting, poised, silent, and swollen. This ghost was waiting for someone. Someone to whisper to. Someone to treasure. It was waiting for a child.
And it's one of several ghosts that make their appearance in the book. What are the challenges of writing for children today?
Well, I think children's authors have always had to be creative in getting rid of the parents. Because if you have too many caring and loving adults around, the main character, children, can't solve their own adventures, you know, solve their mysteries, have a interesting adventure, and have any story worth telling about. And so many children's books have orphans as main characters. You know, Harry Potter, all through, you can look at how many they get rid of the parents that way. I got rid of the parents by sending them to visit an aunt, and aunts are loving, but they're not quite the same as parents. But another thing that people have to, that children's authors have to contend with these days is the cell phone and technology and all the surveillance devices that we impose. So not only do you as the author have to find a way to separate the caring adults from the children, you also have to find a creative way to separate the technology from the kids. So if you read children's books, you'll see that cell phones are dropped and they're submerged in water and they're flung off moving vehicles and the batteries run down. You have to find a way to let the children be on their own so that they can really have an adventure. Otherwise, there's no climax and no excitement. The adults and the cell phones would protect it.
So England and the U.S., contemporary story, but there are differences that you had to research.
Yeah, these are American children who go to visit England. So there's a mix of both cultures going on. And as I said, I used to live in England as a child, and I've been there many times. I have British family. So I thought, I sort of overconfident. I thought, oh, I know all this. But then I realized I always get test readers for my manuscripts. And some of my test readers are children for a children's book, and some are children's librarians, teachers, etc. But for this book, because of the setting, being in a different country, I reached out and I got three British test readers. And boy, I thought I'd get a handful of corrections of little things that I might have overlooked. And I came back, they gave me 135 mistakes that they'd found. And so I learned all sorts of things, such as an ambulance in England, although I'd just described it as being white with red flashing lights, it's neon yellow with red and yellow checkers and blue flashing lights. So lots of details that I had to laughingly accept from my British readers.
And even the difference between 911 and...
Yeah. Well, I wanted to get rid of the ability for the children to call for help. If there's an emergency, you know, you call for mom, you make a phone call, or you call 911. And I wanted to get rid of all those options. So it was convenient that 911 is not the right phone number to call in England. You're supposed to call 999.
So you have American characters, the children and their aunts, and you have British characters. And I think back to the phrase, two nations divided by a common language. How did you get the idiom correct for the British characters?
Well, some of that was from my memory and from my family, just from my life experience. But some of it was from my test readers, because I specifically set this story in Somerset, and they would make suggestions that if I said little girl, or I would say wee lass in my draft, they would say, well, you would only say wee lass if you were from Scotland. If you're in Somerset, you would say little maid. So they would tell me the exact words to use that was very specific to this area.
You know, and I think kids really like that, the exploring languages and other cultures. I mean, I know I'm drawn to it, and I think the children are too. They have such a plasticity with language at that point.
Yes, and they're more open to learning new words. In fact, I was told by some adult readers that I should make my language, my vocabulary, more simple. And I put up a fight about that because I said, I'm choosing the words that need to be used. I use some vocabulary words that many adults don't know, such as I talk about ovine, which is the sheep. But it's obvious from the context. And children are very open to learning new words through context. So the kids don't mind, and they absorb the words. But the adults think, oh, what's this word? But I really believe we shouldn't dumb down our language when we're writing for children, but use the words that are appropriate to tell the story.
Well, the story has ghosts, but it isn't a ghost story. What do you mean by that?
To me, this is an adventure story. It's a mystery. This is the kind of book that I devoured as a child. A group of kids, often siblings, sometimes with a fun pet as a sidekick, go off and solve an amazing mystery. And then usually it's a series and you come back and the same kids have an amazing adventure again. It's so exciting, and the stakes are high. The kids are in danger, and it's just it gets you hooked on reading. And I wanted to provide that same just fantastic, exciting reading experience for kids. The fact that there are ghosts as characters, to me, doesn't really make it a ghost story. I used the ghosts because I wanted to explore these ideas about feelings being so big and heavy that you couldn't fully carry them in life. And these children are sort of special kids. They awaken the ghosts, and they're able to help share the burden of their feelings to let them go.
And one of the very special characters is a Newfoundland.
Yes, I have.
A very large dog.
There is a very large Newfoundland dog in this book. And he's lovable, and he's a protector. So even though I'm trying to get rid of the cell phones and the parents, I do have a dog in there who helps protect the children. And he provides comic relief and just somebody big, furry, shaggy, and lovable. And I found that there's a big crowd of Newfoundland dog lovers out there who are delighted to learn that not just Peter Pan has a Newfoundland, but now the Griffins of Castle Cary.
Now, this book has a history that goes back quite a few years. You were working on other book projects when you started this. Could you walk our listeners through the process of early drafts to finally seeing this in print?
Well, sure. You know, I was my previous books were all adult nonfiction, and I was working on those in the daytime. But I found that I wanted to start writing fiction. I didn't have any more daytime left, so I had to start getting up early. And I did this by setting my clock for about 5 a.m. And working for an hour to hour and a half before the children woke up. It's very hard to write a book with a four-year-old pulling on your shirt. So I set my alarm clock to get some early morning time, and I did this for a year. And by the end of the year, I had a semi-draft of a book. And then it wasn't in presentable form, so I set my alarm clock again and got up early for a second year. It took me about 5 years overall to write the book, including letting the book sit and rest, where I just left it alone for a while and came back with new eyes, and then a lot of revisions, which included reaching out to test readers and researching, you know, British specifics for some of the scenes. So it was a long process.
So you've just touched on the business of being a writer, and this is a big part of how your family earns an income. I mean, it's an important job, right? How much time do you spend writing? How much time do you spend on the business of writing, like working with your agent, your publisher, an editor, promotion, personal appearances?
Well, there are all sides to being a writer. Actually, writing is, for me, one of the most fun parts. And also meeting the audience, meeting the readers is really fun for me. But there's a lot in between all that. So most of my actually earning a living from writing comes from speaking engagements and from writing stories for people who hire me either as an editor or as a writer for personal family stories. But then I work on my own creative projects. There are times when a new book comes out where I don't actually write any new words on a new book for a month or so. But most of the rest of the year, I work on probably several hours every morning writing chapters of a new book.
So let's go to the new book. Is there going to be another addition to Griffin's, or is this a one-off?
Well, I'm hoping that readers will like this book so it becomes a series. I already have started book two, which is called The Griffins and the Wild Hunt, which follows a fantastic European legend of Midsummer Eve, when a ghostly pack of hounds race across the sky. And if you get caught up in the wild hunt, you are never seen again. So, of course, my Griffin children have to meet the wild hunt, and the Newfoundland dog jumps into the pack, and they have to go rescue him.
So you went from nonfiction to fiction to this children's book. Do you see this as your future?
Or yes.
At least your near future?
No, I think this is nearly 100% of my future. I've always wanted to write for this age group, 8 to 12-year-olds, and I have so many story ideas waiting in line, clamoring for time so that I can write them. So I'm writing two books for children currently, one about pirates and one the sequel to The Griffins, and I've got more books that want to be written after that, so I can't see an end to it.
So if listeners want more information about you, your books, your appearances, the best place to start is where?
I have a website, heathershoemaker.com, and the Shoemaker is spelled S-H-U-M-A-K-E-R.
I suspect you have a presence on Facebook?
Yeah, I have Facebook, I have a blog, I have a podcast, and I have all kinds of, all my books and my speaking, ways to get in touch with me, to invite me to speak to a school or a book club, is all there on the website.
So you will do personal appearances in schools?
Yes. And in fact, I've ordered I don't own a giant Newfoundland dog. Sometimes I borrow one for appearances that somebody else has, but I've recently ordered a giant stuffed plush version of a Newfoundland dog that I hope to bring with me to school visits, because everybody wants to hug a beautiful chocolate dog.
Heather, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. This is a wonderful book. I've enjoyed reading it. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Aaron. Good to be back.
I'm delighted to welcome Tanya Ann Crosby to Michigan Writers on the Air. Tanya is a New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of more than 30 novels. Her books have been translated into 8 languages. And for the last 8 years, Tanya and her husband have made their home in Northwest Lower Michigan. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tanya, this writing thing, where did it come from? Where did it start?
So that is, you know, I think I've always wanted to be, I've known that I wanted to be a writer from the time that I think I don't remember a time that I didn't want to do that. The only other thing that I remember wanting to do is be a ballerina. That didn't quite work out. And I loved archaeology. But, you know, those were very fleeting notions for me. I have always known I wanted to be a writer. And so when it sort of came to everybody else realized it as well when I was 12 years old, and we were living in a place called Ponce, Puerto Rico, and I had to get my tonsils out, and I didn't want to do it. So my father told me, he said, you know, you can have anything you want. When we got home and he asked me what it was I wanted, I told him that I just wanted his typewriter in my room. So I got it.
The typewriter was the beginning.
That was the beginning.
And when did you actually do your first book?
I didn't actually, I think I had lots of false attempts, and I didn't actually start my first book until after my first child was born. I always thought that I was going to go back to school, and so I've actually never, I don't really say this often, but I didn't finish college. So I immediately, I started college and had my kids, and I thought that I would wait and write once I went to school and learned how to do it. And then one day when my son was about, I think he was about 3 years old, I decided it was time to just get out, you know, the computer. And so I started a mystery novel. Then while I was writing that, I picked up a romance novel that it was by Judith McNaught. And it was a lovely story that just captured my imagination, and it had all my favorite things in it. History and relation. I love people and relationship. You know, I like following people and trying to figure out what makes them tick and then putting it on paper. And so I read this novel and I thought, this has everything in it that I love. So I attempted my own and put everything else aside, started a medieval romance. And I didn't really think it was a romance at the time. I thought it was a medieval mystery. And so I sent it into 10 agents, and all of them, but I think one or two, wrote back they wanted to represent me. And it happened so quickly that, you know, I didn't have time to really think about it. You know, I just I went with the first one who got back to me, which is a huge no-no. You don't do that. But it worked because she asked me where I wanted to send that novel. And I said, I wanted to send it to, I said, let's get rejected by the top of the line. So we went to Avon Books, and it just so happened that Avon bought it. So the rest is history.
How many books then did you do in that first burst of writing and publishing?
I think I had written 15 or 16 books by the time I decided that I needed a break. So, and they were, at that point, all of them were historical romances.
Okay, let's talk about romances and the different genres in women's fiction and women's romance. You've got historical, which you've worked in.
Correct.
The Highland Bride series, that's part of the genre? Or?
It is part of the genre. Those were actually, that's an early series that I wrote, and it didn't really start out being a series. I'd at that point written, I think that my first Scottish romance was like six books into my career, and I wrote it, and it sold so well that Avon came back to me and said, you know, do that again. So I did it again, and, you know, it sold well. And I did that four or five times before I was kind of done. Because when I set about writing that particular series, it wasn't intended to be a series, and it was painful. You know, so by the time I got to the fourth or fifth book, I was done and ready to move on to something else.
And the something else you moved on to was what?
Well, so at that point, I needed a break from the politics of publishing entirely. So I took a sabbatical and went to work as the editorial director for a stable of magazines in Dallas. And, you know, I also, for a short while, worked in the marketing department at Match.com, writing for the marketing department there. And actually, I was their senior editor and kind of wrote for the website and anything they needed me to do.
So that was about 10 years?
That was overall about 10 years.
What brought you back?
By the time, you know, I kind of went back and forth from, you know, the magazines to Match, then back to the magazines. They kind of lured me back. And I found myself, you know, as I was editing other people's work, I found myself really missing the writing aspect of it. But my own writing, not so much. You know, I didn't really want to go back to doing articles or, you know, I missed writing books.
In the early years, and we're talking about the 1990s, your uh-huh. early years, your first decade of writing. In an earlier conversation, you told me about the covers on the books, which anyone who's passed through a bookstore, at least during that time, or an airport, the covers were fairly amazing. And the story you told me was also intriguing.
Right. So, you know, in the early days of the industry, they just, those, you know, the, you know, of course, nobody really can say for sure how the romance cover came along, who created it and why and whatever. But the story goes that, and it makes sense. It was actually created at a time when women were not the distributors and they were not the buyers. And, you know, so they were created by men for men who were purchasing them. The covers were, anyway, for men who were purchasing them for the, you know, for the public at large and for, you know, the bookstores. And so they weren't really created to appeal to women. They were created to appeal to the men who were stocking the shelves.
And who would probably never read the books.
And who probably would never read the books.
In romance fiction, the main reader, female, right?
Correct.
And in the fiction market, this segment is about a third of the books sold.
Absolutely. The romance reader, they will devour novels as fast as you produce them. So, you know, these women are they're loyal. They are voracious, you know, in their reading habits, and they are savvy and intelligent and educated.
The data I've found, and it's sort of hard to trace it, but it looks like the majority of readers are about 20 to 50 years age range, some college, and a high percentage of them read at least one book a week.
That's true. Yes. And, you know, so I think the market is changing. And for the classic romances that I wrote, I think that demographic is probably closer. It's difficult to actually put books on a shelf, in a particular spot on a shelf anymore, because, you know, the digital market has really changed the way people buy books and the way they find books. And it also has changed the way that you market books and even what I write, because they're not any longer just going to the romance shelf and pulling books off the romance shelf, or the books that I'm writing these days, you know, just kind of really, blur the lines, yeah. The genre lines. They're just no longer.
So we need to contrast that with, in the early days, the convention was, it was a love story, and how did it end?
Always happily ever after.
Yeah, yeah. And what you're suggesting is that no longer is true. There is a segment of the market where that still is true, but the genre is growing and changing. That's the break I want to make. The women's mm-hmm. fiction that you're doing now, how is that different?
In the books that I'm writing now, I'm dealing with heavier topics. And, you know, so I do blur the lines quite a lot. But the major difference between the two is that for my women's fiction titles, I'm definitely dealing with much, much heavier topics. And there's not necessarily a happily ever after.
Now, your readers, you have one group of readers who are very loyal to your titles as romances, and now that you are moving into this area of women's fiction, your readers, some of them who have come into this new area where you're working, are they unhappy with this? Or
some of them are, you know, I have certain readers who they, you know, it seems they feel that I can do no wrong, and they will follow me wherever I go. But there are some readers who just will not follow me over, or who have and aren't as happy. I mean, this is not what they signed up for. You know, when they generally when they've picked up a Tanya and Crosby novel, they have expected that happily ever after, and they're not getting it necessarily in these books. So that does not necessarily suit them.
Your newest book. And we have copies on the table. There are copies around town, I've noticed. Beautiful cover.
Thank you.
Everyday Lies, which is a women's fiction book mm-hmm. as opposed to a romance.
Yes, it is.
Could you talk about that book for a few minutes?
So this book is, the title itself really sort of gives a lot of it away, in the sense that, you know, it's all about the everyday lies that we tell ourselves on a daily basis. It's not necessarily about any particular lie, although there are many lies in this book that have to be uncovered, but it's not necessarily about any particular lie in the book. The book is very much about, and I think it's very relevant, it's very much about women's roles in today's society and the perception of those roles, but not just the perception that men have of those roles, but other women themselves, you know, so.
Yeah, you have this lovely contrast between your protagonist and her grandmother.
I mean, both these characters are very problematic for me, because they both have, I'm trying to think of what I can say without giving too much away, but they both have dark sides, mm-hmm. you know, for lack of a better way to put it. They both have really dark sides. And Jillian's is, the granddaughters is probably more immediately noticeable, and her dark side really kind of was born from her perceptions of what she thinks her grandmother was and what brought her grandmother to the beliefs that she has and how she carried on her life. And it's really colored all of her decisions and not for the better.
So could I get you to read a bit from Everyday Lives?
Sure. Parker, Spring Creek, Legacy, more exits flew past. No matter how many times she made the trek north, it felt as though she were traveling back through time. But times were changing. The bubble surrounding her hometown was getting the air sucked right out of it. Soon McKinney would be just like the rest of North Texas. Zero lot line houses metastasizing like skin cancer across the face of Texas. Used to be, after JFK, but before the boom years, before the tollway, and before the endless highway and outlet centers. The 30-minute drive north was a lonesome sojourn. Flat lands, few trees, the sunset so large it gave the impression of being on a lonely boat adrift at sea, sailing beneath a long, tall moon, except that on this endlessly flat, dusty ocean, the boat cruised north on hot rubber tires, and the moon was a mean, fiery orb that shriveled anything standing too long beneath its steady gaze. For Jillian, this was a good time to contemplate life's little mysteries or mentally pore over the day's schedule, or even just zone out and watch mile markers fly past. Nowadays, it was only the last few miles on Old Mill Road that offered any sense of remoteness, but once on that last stretch of road, the manufactured lawns fell away, and there was an overall impression of brown and white. Although these colors might not seem the greatest sensory experience for most people, brown and white provided Jillian with a strong sense of home. As a kid, it had been the rows and rows of fluffy white balls on twiggy crops that had given Jillian that impression. But the cotton fields had long since vanished by the time she was 10, like her grandfather. Poof. And once those cotton fields were all played out, brown was the only impression for miles and miles beyond the dirty white house. Brown in copious shades, red bed clay, sand-bedded tumblegrass, gold-tipped sagebrush, half mesquite woodlands, half prairie, North Texas was seriously thirsty land. So it was easy to imagine how a bit of mismanagement could whip up a dust bowl. But hey, one guy's drought was another man's gusher, right? At least that's how it seemed. On the heels of Black Sunday, Henry Hayden Noble, Jillian's great-granddad, picked up the house around Noble Ranch, plus a small house for something like $200 per acre from a couple who couldn't afford to hold on to their land. The worst of the droughts were further north, up in the panhandle. But with a sickly kid and another baby on the way, the couple escaped east. That failed investment became Henry Noble's gusher, not Texas tea per se, but the next best thing, cotton. Cotton was McKinney, Texas's version of black gold. Luckily, Henry had saved a bit of money from the sale of illegal whiskey, and with his savings, he'd made a new beginning for his family in McKinney, Texas. But unlike her father and grandfather, Henry Hayden Noble hadn't been a bad guy. Just a man who'd believed in searching for silver linings in dark clouds. Some people were like that. She knew a guy who'd invested in airline stocks the day after 9/11, only Jillian couldn't help but wonder if there could be some kind of bad karma in that kind of thinking. Karma that wove its way into the fabric of family and inalterably changed it.
Tanya Ann Crosby reading from her new novel, Everyday Lies, and on the cover, crossed hands and a cotton ball. For us Northerners, that's not a common thing.
No, actually, I can't tell you how many people have actually looked at this cover and they've said, you know, beautiful cover. What kind of flower is that?
So this has been 30 years, 30 books, more than 30 books. This is not a hobby. This is your everyday job. Lots of writers start out saying, I want to write a novel. They get 30 or 40 pages into it. It's really hard work. How do you approach it? How do you make this happen?
You know, I when people ask me that question, you know, the first thing, aspiring writers in particular, the first thing I say to them is that the difference between, you know, an aspiring writer, I mean, and granted, there's a little bit of talent and luck and all of these things come into play, but the difference between an aspiring writer and a published writer is perseverance and dedication. And, you know, so really when it comes right down to it, that's the secret, is that you have to sit down every day. You have to, you know, grab your computer, your coffee, whatever it is that you have to do to get, you know, ready to have a day. And you have to be willing to do this, for me, 7 days a week, every day, 365 days a year.
So your process, you draft, you revise, what exactly do you do? And how do you start?
So in the morning, you know, I get up and I get my coffee and find my favorite spot, which actually, you know, isn't necessarily the same one every day. You know, I kind of will recognize that spot in the house that, you know, will give me the most inspiration. And I actually work on a laptop because I do not feel creative at a desktop for some reason. You know, I have this great desk that is set up ready for me to work at, and I never work there. I write emails and other things there, but I don't actually write there. So I grab my laptop, and, you know, so I have a very modest word count that I allow myself on a daily basis. I don't want to scare myself. So I give myself 500 words, which is extremely modest. Some days I don't even make that. And some days I'll get, you know, lucky and I'll do 2000 words. But if I can do 2000, I can do 5. I've done 10 in a day when I'm pressed, but those are scary numbers. So I don't do that to myself.
And when writers finish that first book and go to publication, can you give them some counsel then? It's hard still to find an agent, to find a publisher. Some people self-publish.
Right.
But there are some pitfalls there too. What's your advice?
So, you know, in this day and age, I don't know that I would wait on an agent, or I would necessarily go the traditional publishing route. That's not to say that you shouldn't go that route. But, you know, it takes the self-publishing route is, and I actually currently do both. I'm what in the industry we call a hybrid writer, a hybrid author. I actually do my women's fiction titles for the Story Plant, a small boutique publisher. And then I do my genre fiction under my own imprint and self-publish those now. You know, that was always, obviously not always the case. But self-publishing takes enormous dedication. And you know this. You know, it takes enormous dedication and, you know, a lot of work. You can't bypass the editing process. You can't just slap a stock photo up on your book and expect it to sell. It takes much more work than going the traditional publishing route. If you're not, you know, up for that kind of work, I would suggest continuing to inquire at publishing houses and with agents. And these days, I think it's important to have an agent if you're going to deal with the publishing houses. And I think it's almost necessary, because I don't know that I think it's just changed to such a degree that it's, you know, that market is I think an agent's important. If you're going the self-publishing route, I wouldn't bother with an agent at all at this point. But
your words, your counsel about the importance of editing. Most self-publishers, their first book, they sell less than 50 copies. And there's a reason for that.
Right. Your first book really needs to hit the ground running and be, you know, something wonderful that makes them come back and buy your second.
If listeners want to learn more about your work, they should go to your website, which is?
It is www.TanyaAnnCrosby.com, and that is Ann with an E.
Yes.
And Tanya with an A.
And it's a very complete website, including advice for writers.
Yes. You know, I think that at this point in my life, you know, I'm trying to give back to the writing community as much as I possibly can.
And this new book, you're starting to make appearances around this area, and I imagine across the country eventually. How can listeners find where you're going to be and when you're going to be there? Is this on your website? Do you do this in Facebook? How do you do this?
I actually do them both places. You can go to my website, and right there on the front page, all of my events are listed at the bottom. I think you have to scroll down, but they're all listed on the bottom of that page. But you can – I also I have a Facebook page, and that is I think it's Facebook / Tanya Ann Crosby. And you can go to my events there as well. I mentioned I also have a Facebook group and Twitter, the normal suspects. So
I've noticed that you are appearing on all platforms in a very professional way. Tanya Ann Crosby, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on Interlochen Public Radio. Fleta Brown is here. Welcome, Fleta.
Hi, Aaron. I have an amazing book of poems to tell you about. It's very deservedly a Michigan notable book for 2018. The title is Harborless by Cindy Hunter Morgan. Morgan teaches at Michigan State. She's made a study of shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. In this book, each shipwreck is represented by a poem, plus there are six poems in the voice of a deckhand. The titles of the poems are ships, like these: Henry Steinbrenner, 1909, J. Oswald Boyd, 1936, Phoenix, 1847, Brewster, 1943, and so on. Some of the wrecks have survivors, some not. Morgan has taken the bare facts and imagined into them what might have been the case. She did a lot of research for this book, obviously, but the poems have managed, and I know how hard this is, to free themselves of the sense of reading encyclopedia entries. They're true poems. So here's one. This is called Matafa, 1905. That's the name of the ship, Lake Superior. The captain waded through flooded passageways, his shins pushing against water, his feet slowed by a current that kept growing. The last of the kerosene lamps burned out, the matches were wet, the rags wet, as he waded rivers on moonless nights, waiting for holes to swallow him, wary of snags. Still, water poured in, a fluent stream bent on mutiny, and the captain waded through it, against it, fleeing in clothes so wet they clung to him like leeches. In darkness, he groped for the simplest thing, dry tinder, something to help him see what was left of the governed world, pilot house and portholes, and the pale flesh of his men still bailing the surging insurgent wave. He questioned if he ever commanded anything, the wheel, the galley, the deck, the men, the ever-rising uprising. Doesn't that poem put you there? It's scary the way it brings you into the rising water and the mind of the captain. What I notice is that after a few of these poems, we become extremely aware, as the poet Kevin Prufer said in a blurb for the book, of the forces that buffet all of us, often wildly and violently, during and after our lives. There are notes on each wreck at the end. This is what we learn about this one. It was so famous that a storm and a cigar were named after it. The storm of November 1905 is known as the Matafa Blow. There was an audience for this wreck. The ship had turned back for Duluth and tried to shoot the chutes of the Duluth piers. People lined Canal Park and watched a wave slam the Matafa into the North Pier. The ship lost power and was beached about 600 feet from shore. 12 men were in the bow and 12 in the stern. 3 men made it out of the stern and into the safer bow before the ship split in the middle. The 9 men left in the stern died. 15 men in the bow lit lamps and fires to stay warm. The crowd in Canal Park built bonfires on the rocks to watch the disaster. The men in the bow were rescued the next day. The bodies in the stern had to be cut from the ice. Well, I'm sorry, I couldn't stop reading the note. It's so interesting. But it's one thing to have good stories to tell. It's another to write a good book of poems. These poems are crisp, offering enough detail, but opening the tale to what can be imagined of it. I'll give you one without the notes. You can see the notes are fun, but not at all necessary. This is called Waldo, 1913, Lake Superior. The passengers have made a fire in the captain's bathtub and are gathered around it, eating tinned peaches with their fingers. After they burn the legs of the washstand and after the tinned fruit is gone, a few things remain to tether them to this world. One door to the pilot house, ripped from its hinges by three deckhands, one life jacket, which sits like the last peach no one will eat, one megaphone a woman holds quietly in her lap like a sleeping baby. She strokes it gently, as though silencing a wild holler hiding inside. Cindy Morgan chooses perfect details, but then she always opens the poem out at the end in some gesture, like that gorgeous gesture of the woman stroking the megaphone. Not all is catastrophe, though. Here's one with a happier ending. Brewster, 1943, St. Clair River. Water leaks into the hold, leaks and slowly soaks 90,000 bushels of Lend-Lease wheat until the hold is a swelling belly that expands as the wheat expands, until what is swelled buckles the plates. Soon the ship will sink, the wheat will sink, the charts charting the way to England will sink, and the manifest manifesting the wheat, cargo that is itself a manifestation of expansiveness, will sink. The crew will escape, so close are they to Walpole Island, so close to people with wool blankets and hot coffee and cream of wheat, bowls of cream of wheat, men will spoon into their bellies, warm holds that will expand with gratitude, and some kind of fortitude that kept people in 1943. From buckling. The poem is carried, it seems to me, by that music of repetition. It's kind of like a song, as in manifest, manifesting the wheat, a cargo that is itself a manifestation. You don't really find a forward movement in this book. It's simply a collection. Each poem stands in its own space. There's the structural device of the deckhands poems that offer what each poem title calls a theory, as in deckhand scent theory, deckhand sound theory, and game theory, dream theory, and so on. The deckhand is not in the immediacy of the situation exactly. He's dreaming, considering, thinking of words, and so on. These poems work like commentary and are very welcome to me to have a way to step back emotionally a bit from wreck after wreck. The last poem in the book is called Deckhand Word Theory, that plays with the words collide and sink. The poem literally breaks the words apart into other words. Here are just the last six lines. Listen to the S, air going out of an inflatable raft. Think about N. In water, in ice, reconnect the S. Sink comes after sin. Hear the K, hard sound, caw of gulls circling a wreck. And that's the way it ends. I admire this book a great deal, both the idea of it and the conception of it. Cindy Hunter Morgan is the poet. This is her first full-length collection of poems. It's published by Wayne State University Press.
Thank you, Fleeta. Thank you. now is Betsy Braun, the manager of the Interlaken College of Creative Arts. Betsy, would you tell our listeners about some of the adult programs for writers that are being sponsored here at Interlaken this spring and summer?
Hi, Aaron. Thank you for having me over to the station. We have a number of wonderful programs. We have some poetry classes. We have a writers, readers, and story, a prose workshop for Works in Progress with Patricia McNair. We have the Live Your Art Retreat with Holly Wren Spaulding, and that is open to all kinds of artists, not just writers or poets. Then we have our annual Writers Retreat. So this is the 14th year of the Writers Retreat, and last year we went away from having the traditional genres of fiction, nonfiction, memoir, poetry, and we decided to go with craft concepts instead. So there are four courses to choose from. A couple are full, but we have some wonderful faculty joining us. And then later in June, we have the Mystery Writing Intensive. That's always a very popular class, so check that out soon. In July, we have a Poetry Writing Intensive on short poems. And then in August, we have a class on creative nonfiction called Writing the World. So there's a variety of programs. Some are one day, some are 3 days, some are 4 days. They are open to all levels, except for the one with the Works in Progress. But it's clearly stated in all the descriptions if there is any kind of prerequisite as far as skill level goes. But our faculty are all published authors and very good teachers.
So if people are feeling a little bit apprehensive about this, they've always wanted to write something or be a writer, but they've never settled down to do it, that's not a problem.
No, I really don't think it is. We have a lot of very caring instructors. And if you have any doubts, you could call the office, and I'd be happy to discuss it with you. But I suggest that you really read the descriptions on the website. We try to put as much information in there as possible. We also have the daily schedule, so you can see what the sessions are going to cover. You can link to the faculty members' personal website and read about them. So there's really a lot of information out there, but I'm happy to speak with anyone who would like to contact us directly.
And talking about radio, you're doing something with broadcast as well?
Yes, we also have this May 17th to 19th, we're offering Introduction to Digital Audio, and that is in conjunction with Interlaken Public Radio. And it's going to be taught by none other than the director of IPR, Peter Payette.
Great. And in addition to the writing programs, you have a whole array of other arts-related programs for adults.
Yes, we do. We have a lot of music programs. We have piano for adults. We have a great couple of Mount and Dulcimer classes coming up in June that are really wonderful. We have, for those who want to learn a little behind the scenes, we have Introduction to Music Publishing by a wonderful artist's lawyer who's very good and knows all the ins and outs of music publishing. And then we have our big programs, choir camp, adult choir camp, the flute choir camp, techniques in fingerstyle guitar workshop. And we have a couple of Grammy-winning artists that are guest technicians in that program. And at the end of the summer in August, we have adult band camp and Adult Chamber Music Camp, both longtime programs that are very popular. In addition to the music, we also have a lot of visual arts program, and those are very much geared toward all levels. So if somebody's been away from, say, a painting for a while, they could take a class here and be refreshed, learn some new techniques. But if they're a beginner, they're also going to learn a lot and be very welcome.
So if listeners want more information about these programs or to register, what's the best way to do that, Betsy?
Well, you can go to the regular interlaken.org website and click on Lifelong Arts Learning. Or if you want to get directly there, you can go to college.interlaken.org and see all of our upcoming programs.
And if they want to call you?
If they want to call in, the number is 231-276-7387. And there will be voicemail if someone's out of the office. So just leave a message and we'll call you back.
Betsy Braun, the manager of the Interlochen College of Creative Arts, thank you for coming by.
Thank you, Aaron. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. My thanks to Heather Shoemaker, Tanya and Crosby, Betsy Braun, and Fleeta Brown. Also, kudos to Daniel Wanshura for his skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, this is Aaron Stander wishing you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.